everyone. Welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, March 4th, 2019. Can you believe it? And I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. Before we dive into what we're going to do today, I want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. And you know, you can support the show in a ton of ways. One of the most important is just telling people about it. It's listening to the show, downloading it, telling your friends and family that they too should have a listen and maybe they'll learn a thing or two. You can also buy super cool Talk Nerdy merch at, what do you know, talknerdymerch.com. I've got everything under the sun, from hoodies to beanies to, I don't know, tank tops to socks, even mugs. And of course, three books that I've been involved in: the National Geographic Almanac 2019, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and Charlie and the Tortoise, a children's book. And if you order one of those from my website instead of from, you know, Amazon or somewhere else where you can buy them, which is fine, you should totally buy them anywhere you want, but if you order one from my website, I'll sign it and personalize it just to you before I send it out. But the other way you can support the show is by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy. Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. I might have already said that. It's like autopilot at this point. And that's because of support from listeners just like you. So this week, I want to thank Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell for their support of the show. In addition to the literally hundreds of people who pledge, you know, a dollar or two to help support the show. It's hugely, hugely helpful. It's because of you that this show does stay on the air. So thank you so very much from the bottom of my heart. All right, guys, this week it's a good one. I talked to Dr. Christina Ropella. She goes by Chris, and she is a lot of things. She is the Opus College of Engineering Dean of Marquette University. She's also a professor of biomedical engineering and the director of the joint PhD program in functional imaging between Marquette University and the Medical College of Wisconsin. And we talk about all sorts of cool stuff, everything from, you know, being the dean of an engineering department, which is a lot, down to what her research involves, where she focuses on fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, signal processing, the engineering that goes into these biomedical signals. It's a fascinating conversation about biomedical engineering and more. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Chris Ropella. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to chat with you.
Absolutely. So you are the Dean of the College of Engineering at Marquette University. Where's Marquette University?
We are in the heart of Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. Nice. So I think what I don't know much about Wisconsin. I know something about cheese and I know something about the accent, but that's pretty much the extent. I know I've been to Wisconsin before, though, because I've visited every state. But it's definitely like the heart of the Midwest in many ways, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a wonderful place to be. You know, it's a weather-wise, we have great variety if you want to experience a lot of good variety here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin. But it's just a great big town, small city, I think, you know, a very warm and welcoming place in terms of the people who live here and what we believe in terms of, you know, those sort of the Midwest values. And there's a humbleness to the area, maybe sometimes too much so, but just a great city. And of course, we have our urban challenges as well, which is why I like being here at Marquette University. We are a Jesuit institution, and as Jesuit institutions, we have a very strong belief in being in the middle of urban environments. And as I like to say, our students look at real life in the face every single day as they're walking the streets on their campus, and they're observing firsthand many of the challenges and issues that we face in urban environments. And so it's great in that context, and just the liveliness. We have a lot of great local industry here that supports student internships and co-op. We have a great lake. It's a wonderful resource for us in the city in terms of recreation as well as a source of water. And yeah, it's just, you know, it's very livable. It's affordable. Great, a lot of many great restaurants, good music venues, a lot of small theater, and we have all the major sports teams. So it's a great city to live in, and it's easy to get around, and I just think really great people.
You know, it's funny because I think of myself as semi-tri-coastal in a way. I was born and raised in Texas. I moved to New York, to the city for a while, and now I've been living in Los Angeles for about a decade. And I think sometimes the kind of coastal individuals forget that the big cities aren't actually clustered on the coast. That yes, LA and New York are the two biggest cities in our country, and San Francisco is quite large as well. But, you know, like I said, Texas has huge cities. The Midwest has huge cities. Like, it's not all rural farmland in between the coast.
Right. And people tend to, they forget that. And you're right. We do have big cities, and many of them are growing now, even more so in the Midwest, as you look at what's happening in Nashville and what we hope is, you know, sort of a rejuvenation here in Milwaukee, as well as more and more industries find this to be an attractive spot to set up their headquarters and find the workforce that they're looking for. So, and I always like to say we have a coastline as well. So when you're standing, when you're standing on the shores of Lake Michigan, it doesn't look that different from an ocean. We don't have quite the waves for surfing, but you know, it's still a coast, and we enjoy. And we also have a lot of smaller inland lakes in the greater Milwaukee community that people enjoy and like to live on, and as well.
Yeah, I grew up in lake culture for sure. We had a boat when I was a kid, and we'd go out all the time. It was one of my favorite pastimes, is going water skiing and tubing and all that good stuff.
Same here. We enjoy it here.
So, you know, you mentioned industry and how important industry is to growing cities. And I think that's a good tie-in because you are, as I mentioned, the dean of the College of Engineering. And something that may pique people's interest or may feel like, oh, that's, you know, that's different. That's interesting. If they're aware of some of the issues that we've been facing for many, many years in STEM, especially with regards to minority representation and gender parity, is that, you know, the gender equity is probably at its worst in engineering and computer science compared to almost every other STEM field. And it makes me wonder, you may not have the stats offhand, but it makes me wonder how common it is for a woman to hold the position of dean in an engineering department.
Yeah, so thank you for that. Yeah, it's one of the things that I think we're striving for, certainly in our college, are part of our strategic plan, or really our strategic plan, and I call it changing the face of engineering. And there are really three aspects of that: changing the face of the people who are coming into engineering and becoming part of the engineering workforce, changing the face of our graduates and the way we educate and prepare our people for the real world, and then changing the face of our college and how the world looks at us and how we're serving the world. So that piece about bringing a more diverse population of people to the engineering workforce is really important. I think that hasn't been done in decades. And I think engineering, a lot of engineers tended to just hire a lot of people who are exactly like themselves, look like themselves. Mm-hmm. It was a comfortable thing. And yet, we talk a lot about innovation in engineering. And I think if engineering really wants to be an innovative and entrepreneurial field, you need to represent people from all walks of life. And the more we can bring people from diverse backgrounds, experiences, to problem solving, to engineering work, the much more innovative and creative we're going to be. And so we're really working on that. In particular, for me, I look at women, right? And women, it's really important to bring in. And the needle on a national scale, the needle of the percent of women enrolled in undergraduate engineering programs really hasn't changed much. It peaked around 2002 at about 22-23%, and it's actually declined over the last, you know, couple decades. Here in the college, we are working hard to increase that. And so we're at about overall college, I think about 26%, but our freshman class this year was 30% women. I have a personal goal of wanting to get that to be 50% in 5 years. So something we need to make happen, and we need to think about how do we make the engineering field more attractive by letting women know that engineers do a lot of great stuff in terms of leadership, in terms of careers that you maybe hadn't thought about, that an engineer can enter when they get out of school and lead in their life. And so, yes, and part of that is having women faculty and women deans. Mm-hmm. That students can look to and recognize that, oh gosh, I kind of look like her, and you know, and I see myself being able to do the same sort of thing. So, in terms of women deans across the country, I believe we're up to about 26 women deans of engineering out of over 350 programs. So, still a small number. Yeah, wow. It's a small number, but I can say in the last 2 to 3 years, it's definitely been rising. You're seeing more and more come into those roles. colleges of engineering that are also combined with science, so some of them are colleges of engineering and sciences, you see a greater number because many of those women come out of sciences. So there's more women in fields like biology, maybe even chemistry than, let's say, engineering or physics. So a little bit more women in that pipeline. But even in engineering, we're seeing it grow, and it's great to see this happening and that women are being put in these positions. And they're excited. They're excited to for the opportunity they have as deans to make real change in the demographics of our students. I think the numbers are even smaller, honestly, for underrepresented minorities. And again, something else we really need to address and help our own students that we're bringing through the pipelines to say, you can be in those roles too, and here's how we can help you get there.
Absolutely. You know, I've mentioned this before on the show, guys. I might sound a little bit like a broken record, but I always highly recommend Jen Siebel Newsom's documentary, Misrepresentation, because I think it's one of the few documentaries out there that specifically singles out this conversation about, it's not just about what we call in academia, the leaky pipeline, but it's about the issue of, yes, the first step is getting people in at the ground floor, but ultimately, where we're seeing the worst division is at the highest levels of management, at corporate boardrooms, at, like you said, tenured professorships, dean levels, that there's a huge disconnect between starting the process and staying in the process and being in many ways a decision maker across the board, whether we're talking about academia, industry, or any other platform. So maybe you can speak a little bit to that conversation about what we've deemed sort of the leaky pipeline.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that because I think I've experienced it even watching many of my peers and colleagues as I was going mm-hmm. through school, graduate school, in the profession. I've watched the number of women who've dropped out, and it's really a shame because really talented young women gave up early on, particularly in academia, saying, I can't do this. I can't balance this career and also be responsible for this family that I'm trying to raise at a time when it was still pretty much up to the women to be managing much of that family load. And by the way, there were young men, mm-hmm. too, who were dual career families who are experiencing the same thing. So it wasn't just such a women's issue. It was more of a family work, you know, balance kind of issue as well. But yeah, I watched a lot of women drop out, certainly in academia. So women who had gone on, got their PhDs, thought they wanted to try being a faculty position, and within a couple of years have dropped out. In fact, most of the women that I was in graduate school with did that. And it's really a shame and really never got back into the workforce, which think about the talent you're losing there. What I often see now sometimes as I'm going to board meetings and even corporations, I mean, the highest leadership, is I still see that much more older generation of male who's in those C-suite levels who are very uncomfortable having conversations with a women leader. So it's very interesting to watch that. Mm-hmm. For some reason, they don't think they can talk about the same topics with you that they do with the other men in the room. And I'll see it, like they have a hard time, you know, looking me in the eye or think about the talk about. And I thought, I talk about the same thing as those other guys, whether you want to talk about business, economics, what's going on in our city, or I can talk about sports too. And I can talk about, you know, sailing and boating and whatever yeah. it is that you want to talk about. So that's where I often see that. And so it can be frustrating, right? Because it's a little bit isolating at times. And I mean, I don't have a problem leaning in. So I have no problem looking these people in the eye and forcing a conversation if I need to. And it, you know, again, done the right way, you can usually bring them around a short period of time where suddenly they're feeling comfortable and they get it and it's better. But a lot of women aren't comfortable in those situations or do feel isolated and don't feel like, again, I don't see anybody like me here in this room. And am I going to be able to make a difference? And are people going to respect me? And can I really be successful? So yeah, I see that too. But what bothers me is the dropout in that pipeline. So one of the things we've been talking mm-hmm. about here in our college, something that I've wanted to do for some time, is create some onboarding programs so that women who did get an engineering degree and were in engineering and dropped out for a period of time to have children and raise their family can get back into it. And really, right now, they don't find a way to do that. And so how can we work with industry and create some unique educational programs so that as children start going to school, these women maybe have some time in their day or whatever, we can help them become reacquainted with the profession and refresh some of those skills and learn some new things so that they can get back if they want to. And that isn't happening, but we're making some real efforts in that area now to make that happen.
That's wonderful. I mean, it's really good to hear. And I know it's an uphill battle and it's going to be a long road. And I mean, it's somewhat unfortunate that it's the women in those positions who are having to work sort of as the, you know, at the bleeding edge. It makes sense, of course, but it is somewhat unfortunate. And it's always good when I hear about individuals in these positions who also have a lot of allies, a lot of male allies, who are working hard to advocate. We don't often hear those stories as often.
Right,
so
right.
Important, right?
But they are out there, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, we have to, I mean, the men have to be in with this too. And I will just share with you that my most influential mentors as I went through school and in my career path, it really have been men, and men who were well connected and who well networked, who took me in and said, here, I'm going to introduce you to all these important people. I'm going to advocate for you. I'm going to be a sponsor for you. And they were the really ones I credit for really giving me the confidence to move ahead and say, I can do this. And it really was the male mentors in my life. Everything from my father to my, you know, graduate school advisor to my first department chair when I was a faculty member and beyond. And those men were actually very influential and believed in me and helped put me right in the middle of those conversations and in the middle of those important decisions, and also shared a lot with me as confidants, and that helped me in terms of the university system, learning just exactly how a university worked and what were the inner politics and all that went on. I learned at a very early stage in my faculty career, and it's actually really benefited me in terms of how I function as a dean today.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the conversation has to become a bigger conversation than just kind of undoing what we think of as these moral wrongs of history, you know, changing the tide from a time when women really didn't have rights, when women couldn't vote, when women couldn't advocate for themselves. And a lot of this lack of representation comes from a holdover from that. And yes, obviously, a big part of these programs is trying to sort of level the playing field, both for women and minorities, who obviously have suffered an even more dire fate historically. But beyond that, when people say, yeah, but why? Yeah, but why? You often hear these arguments of like, well, maybe men are just better at engineering, or maybe men just right. like engineering more. And it's like, no, you haven't done the research. Like, we need to talk about something that's even more fundamental here, which is why it's so important to have multiple perspectives at the table.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a good point. Is first of all, I can't remember who said this to me at one point, but many years ago, I remember a woman leader saying, "We don't need to break the glass ceiling. We need to tear down the whole building. Mm-hmm. Right? We need to create a whole new building that is welcoming to a much more diverse population of participants in the engineering workforce, right? Let's tear it all down and start over so it serves men, women, minorities, everybody in a different way than it does now." So it is rebuilding that building instead of just trying to break through someone else's glass ceiling. I think the other important thing is, people have this stereotype of engineering, right? Well, men like it better. Well, it's because that stereotype has been created by generations of people who hired and people who look just like themselves. And when you walk in a lot of companies today, and I walk the manufacturing floors and the engineering areas, it still looks like that. Yeah. And I can see it. I know a lot of engineers, and kind of the old stereotype of they're comfortable with people who are a lot like themselves. And there's just been this kind of hiring. And it's only in probably the recent decade that we've talked a lot differently about how we hire and how we think differently about what we hire and getting out of that. So engineering has some terrible stereotypes that I'm working really hard to change and say to women coming in and minorities and other groups who have been underrepresented, you can change it. Engineering can have a whole different look to it, but we need to make it happen. And you as people, we need to be part of that change, right? We can't expect anyone else to do it. We're part of it. And sometimes it's going to be hard, and we've got some big hurdles to get over, and we're going to be pushing up against some tough walls. But if we don't do it, you can't expect the existing engineers who've been in here for a long time to do it.
Yeah, you know, it's true. It's going to take these sort of architects working from, I guess, in many ways, the top down. But there's also, again, this bottom up movement where I think the change, because as a society, we're moving in a progressive way with regard to equity and parity, it's slowly but surely changing anyway, which is a really good thing. Obviously, we have to break down some barriers and we have to work really hard to secure a pathway. But it's cool to see that these changes are occurring because women are not sitting still and waiting quietly. Ethnic minorities are not sitting still and waiting quietly. They're saying, hey, you can make good money in this career. Hey, I have a fundamental interest in how things work. Like, I want to be involved in this.
Exactly, exactly. And I, that's exactly right. And people are saying we want to make the change. And we actually, and it's not just being a participant in the profession, but also being a leader in the profession. And to get more diversity in our leadership, that'll be a good thing. We started an undergraduate leadership program specifically in our engineering college a few years ago. Leadership is sort of a hobby of mine. I have a lot of books on it. I like to read about it and think about it. And I think a lot about, I reflect a lot on my own leadership and how I can be most effective in my organization. And the idea of leadership and how teams work has been changing a lot over the last decade or so and the thinking about it. And one of the things we wanted to do is, as a Jesuit institution, leadership is one of our four pillars. And I think too long in the past, we left leadership development to chance, right? So you were in a job for 10 years and someone put you into a management or leadership position and said, here, go do it. And as a result, many, I can tell you, engineers fail in that sense. And I think some companies will still tell you there still is an issue. And so we wanted to do intentional leadership development in our engineers during their undergraduate year. So we created a 3-year program. And one of the reasons that I wanted to create that program is I really believe that we would attract more women and ethnic minorities to engineering if we did it, because I think many people in those particular groups are looking for leadership opportunities, right? They want to be leaders. They want to make change. They want to do things differently. And so by doing this, I think it helps us to attract some different types of students to the college in the first place. But certainly when they're applying for that, we have to apply for the program. We are over 50% women in the program. And I think we're about 35% ethnic minority in the program too. Like there's definitely, we're definitely seeing what we hope we would see in terms of the diversity of student who is participating in that leadership program and the excitement they have for what they think they'll be able to do when they go out into that workforce and the difference they'll make in their communities.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I almost see a parallel, at least in academia, between, as you mentioned, sort of leadership training, management training, which oftentimes you see that people will, in industry or in different corporations, they'll like climb the ranks because they're very good at their jobs and they'll find themselves in management positions with no training in how to actually manage. And you see a similar thing happening in academia where people are very good scientists, for example, and they'll sort of climb the ranks, but they've never been taught how to teach. And so then they're stuck in these professorships and they have no idea how to reach their students. And it's like, why aren't we training more people how to manage and how to teach?
Right. It's the traditions or the traditions of the institutions, the organizations, the professions, right? That they just think this just sort of happens. And you see it all the time. I have a husband who's also an engineer. He's always been in industry. And when he comes and tells me the stories about his engineering managers and the behaviors, it's just, you know, you and I might go, oh my God, how does anyone behave that way? But, you know, things like emotional intelligence are not obvious to many people, right? And you, just because someone's really good in the technical and science side doesn't mean they know anything about people, right? And managing people and leading people, which is, and again, academia, the same thing. You got a professor who's really good at publishing and running science experiments stuff, and all of a sudden you're putting him into these administrative positions and they're often, you know, failing miserably, and the people that work for them are miserable because no one's given them the opportunity to learn about leadership and even management. And leadership is about two things, really, at its most fundamental: people and change. That's what it's about, right? And how do you lead people through change? And there are lots of good, whether it's books or course or workshops, that you can learn about that, the skills, the attributes, the attitudes about how to do that, how to improve your emotional intelligence, your resilience. What is really effective teamwork? What do we mean by that? How do you have fierce conversations, which, you know, I'll tell you, in university settings, people avoid like the plague, and probably in industry too, but they're so important part of running an organization. So again, being really intentional like that. And after we started this leadership program in engineering, it's really infected, I think, a lot of campus in good ways, and that we finally have some leadership development programs going on for faculty. We are now doing it in HR for supervisors. So people are understanding now this is not fluff, right? And I think that's the other thing that carries over from older leadership in corporations and academia are sort of these more seasoned or senior leaders who thought that was all fluff, right? Like they don't believe in soft skills. And as I like to say to the people who work with me, I don't call them soft skills anymore. I call them essential skills. Like if you really want to be successful in your career, whatever stage level, you have to have these essential skills. And a lot of our leadership development is about those sorts of things. But, you know, for a long time, I think it was just poo-pooed. You had a leadership model where someone was at the top and just dictated everyone below and everybody just followed along. And that still exists in some corporations. But I think a lot of our young workforce today, because of the employment system, it's so hard to find employees these days, and they're not going to put up with that. And so it's, in some ways, it's healthy. It's forcing organizations and companies to think differently about how they treat their employees. How do you work on teams? What are the environments that you work in if you want to attract good talent?
Well, and here's like an interesting paradox, right? Like just like we know by looking at the research that there's nothing fundamental about a man's brain that makes him a better engineer. There's nothing fundamental about a woman's brain that makes her better at these, as you mentioned, so-called soft skills or fundamental skills, these, you know, like emotional intelligence, things like that. But by virtue of our culture and the pressures on us, we often find ourselves leaning in and developing these skills at a different rate and speed. So the funny irony here is that the very skills that we're talking about are skills that many women would potentially bring to the table just by virtue of the way they've had to navigate the world. And people of color, by the way, by virtue of having to navigate microaggressions and having to navigate, you know, not offending people in the room just by their very presence, which is like the grossest, saddest thing, but it's a big part of what it means to grow up in American society as a person of color, for example.
Yeah. Oh, you articulate it. I can't say it better. You articulate it very well. That's exactly right. Because of how you've, you know, the environments you've had to grow up in, the groups of people, the neighborhoods, the schools, whatever. Yes, we have been, I think, more prone, as you said, to, or more likely to really be sensitive in those areas and develop in those areas because we've had to navigate things that, you know, maybe others have not. And just because of the traditional roles, you know, even the women traditionally taking care of the children, it's just been their, it's what they've had to do. And if you talk about one thing where you have to be incredibly emotionally intelligent, most of the time it's raising children, right? and which is good. It's developing some great leadership skills that should carry over, whether you're teachers or whatever it is in some of those more, or nursing, you know, think of professions, you know, for example, we've had a lot of women. It requires that they have a lot of those types of skills versus maybe, you know, running a group of people in a boardroom or whatever. But you're right. And so there is part of, like you said, not necessarily genetic or biological, but it's a factor of environments and how what we have to navigate is a great way to describe that.
And of course, in many ways, I love that segue, right? You would know a little bit or maybe even a lot about these sort of like social science, but also biological science conversations, A, because of the work that you've done in leadership, but B, when it comes to your own research, your own area of expertise. Of course, you're the dean of the College of Engineering, and we think of engineering as something very specific, but you work in biomedical engineering, which is such a cool field because it's multidisciplinary. So I would love to hear about some of the work that you've done or some of the work that individuals within your department are doing on like medical imaging and on these really important tools, development and I guess improvement of these important tools to really help improve health outcomes.
Great. Yeah. As you said, it's a very exciting field. It is very multidisciplinary. That's what I really like about it. I think if it's an area of engineering that has grown up over the last, 30, 40 years or whatever. One of the things I say about biomedical engineers is they grow up in a multidisciplinary environment. They're very comfortable working with teams of people that involve physicians, biophysicists, physical therapists, whatever. We know that we can't do our work unless we have teams like that. So I think compared to some of the more traditional engineering disciplines, biomeds are very comfortable in that multidisciplinary environment. They seek it out. They enjoy it. And as a result, a lot of really cool innovation comes out of it that ultimately hopefully improves healthcare and medical care. So I do a lot of work in what's called signal processing and image processing. So when we measure any kind of, let's say, signals from the body. So for example, I worked in cardiology for a long time, and we can tell a lot about the heart's functioning by measuring electrical signals. So they put little electrodes, sticky electrodes on your body, and we put it in very specific places, and we can record electrical activity in your heart. And that electrical activity can tell us a lot about you know, whether your heart is functioning normally a lot. It's actually a very nice non-invasive diagnostics tool that's been used for many, many decades and still is pretty powerful and used today. But I was the kind of person that was developing, you can call it sort of the artificial intelligence that would be used in things like implantable defibrillators and pacemakers. So you have these devices that we put inside the body to help regulate heart function or to stop a really dangerous heart rhythm. And I sort of worked on the brains of those devices so that that device all by itself could monitor the heart, recognize when there's an abnormal rhythm, and then shock or use some sort of electrical current to modify heart function. So I did that for a lot of years. And as part of that work, also trying to understand abnormal heart rhythms like atrial fibrillation. When I was a graduate student, we were working on that. And at the time, it wasn't really popular amongst companies or anywhere else, but I worked for a cardiac electrophysiologist, Steve Swern, who is at Northwestern University, who's very passionate about it. And as a result, I became very passionate. It affects 3% of our population, and it will be increasing as we have an aging population. So something that happens to a lot of aging people. It's not immediately life-threatening, but can lead to a lot of other complications and stroke and things like that. So we were very interested in understanding, why does atrial fibrillation happen? Why do some people develop it? Why do some people come in and out of it and other people don't? So did a lot of work in understanding the biological mechanisms behind it by using signal processing techniques. So in recent years, I've been working in brain imaging using magnetic resonance imaging. And what's nice about that, again, a non-invasive, non-radiation type imaging that allows us to really look at both white and gray matter in the brain and not only look at structure in the brain, so being able to see a tumor or some abnormal formation or something else in the brain, but also functional imaging where we can actually have people do things where they're looking at something visually or listening to something or doing something tactile. And then in the brain, we can see what parts of the brain are sort of lighting up or actually involved in that activity. So it's a way of looking at brain function now in a non-invasive way. And so that really kind of took off in the early 1990s because of work that's going on at the Medical College of Wisconsin, as well as Mass General in Boston and the University of Minnesota, all sort of discovered this phenomenon at the same time. And so we have a lot of work in that area where you're using what we call functional imaging techniques to actually map brain function, look at brain function, and be able to predict what might happen if you have injury to the brain. Or more importantly, we have about a handful of faculty here in engineering as well as in physical therapy who are very involved in what we call neural rehabilitation, so rehabilitation of the nervous system, brain and spinal cord, and are using some of these imaging techniques to help guide therapy and understanding or sort of quantifying how effective is therapy or how do we modify therapy. So if we want to look at somebody who's had a stroke and who's lost various function, what's the best rehabilitation to bring them back to sort of the state they were before, or at least maximize their potential outcomes with certain types of therapy? And we can use imaging to support that. So imaging in general is a really important tool. And by the way, it involves electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, biomedical engineers, biophysicists, all kinds of different people, as well as, by the way, sociologists, nurses, other healthcare professionals, because the experience itself for the patient may be a little scary or something they don't, they're uncomfortable with, particularly children. And so we have to have these teams of people working together to think about, it's a great imaging technology, but there are limitations in terms of the hardware, the software, how long it takes, the comfort for the patient, you know, those sorts of things that we have to consider as well. But again, imaging is a great area because it's hopefully most of the time it's non-invasive, so it doesn't cause pain. You don't have to go inside someone's body. You know, way better way of being able to look at things diagnostically in a way that doesn't cause pain and discomfort.
All right, everyone. I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with CuriosityStream, the world's first streaming service for addressing our lifelong quest to learn, explore, and understand. CuriosityStream was founded by John Hendricks, the founder of the Discovery Channel, and it's available across like so many platforms. There's a web app. You can watch it on Roku, Android, Xbox One, smart TVs, iOS, Chromecast, Amazon Fire, Amazon Kindle, and Apple TV. It's also available worldwide. So no more country restrictions. And there's content that spans everything from science to nature to history to technology to society and lifestyle. And guys, on CuriosityStream, you can watch amazing content from people I've had on this very show. Remember Sonia Pemberton and her incredible documentaries? Yep, you can watch them on CuriosityStream. I just found an episode of the Joy of series called The Joy of Data, which features Hannah Fry. So she's talking all about data and algorithms. It's so cool, the amount of crossover between the guests that I've had here on Talk Nerdy and all the incredible content on CuriosityStream. It's honestly like made for you guys. I know it is. So go to curiositystream.com/nerdy and you'll get unlimited access to the world's top documentaries and nonfiction series. And just for you, the Talk Nerdy listeners, enter the promo code nerdy when you're prompted during the signup process, and your membership is completely free for the first 30 days. Remember, that's curiositystream.com/nerdy and enter the promo code nerdy when prompted. I also want to thank Eero for their support of the show, because life is too short for bad Wi-Fi. Isn't that the truth? I'm actually recording and sending this to your ear holes right now on an Eero system. Their home Wi-Fi system brings the idea of multiple access points placed throughout a house to consumers for the very first time. So let's talk about what Eero is and how it works. It's total network coverage, total network protection. So simple, reliable security through Eero Plus. This is an important addition here that defends all of your home's devices against a growing number of threats like malware and spyware. You get total network protection to block those things across your entire network. Advanced security, content blocking, ad blocking, all those things combined. But that's in addition to the actual system, because a single router model, it just doesn't work anymore. You need a distributed system. And with Eero, that's what you get. It's an enterprise grade Wi-Fi system that you can set up in your house in just a few minutes. You can manage it from the palm of your hand on the app. And it's clean and it's secure. Traditional routers don't push software updates to their customers, so you're vulnerable to cyber attacks. But Eero makes sure that you're covered all the time, and they have incredible customer support. Like I said, I'm using the Eero system right now, and that's why it sounds so good, people. So come on, I don't know what you're waiting for. You can never think about Wi-Fi again. Wouldn't that be great? And you'll get $100 off the Eero base unit and two beacons package. You'll also get 1 year of Eero Plus, that protection that I mentioned, by going to Eero.com/nerdy and entering the promo code nerdy at checkout. Again, that's Eero.com/nerdy and enter the promo code nerdy at checkout. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. I love hearing you talk about imaging, especially like something functional imaging like fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, from the perspective of an engineer, but also from somebody, a biomedical engineer. So somebody who's working closely with healthcare, because, you know, my background in social science leads me to read a lot of fMRI studies. And most of my perspective on fMRI comes from research. You know, like there's so many papers that are published using fMRI for research protocols. And so, you know, and it's illuminating and it can help, and it has its shortcomings. And, you know, with the way that we use it in research, there are some limitations there as well. But hearing about the incredible importance in a practical applied setting is really refreshing, I think, for me.
Yeah. And thank you. You addressed, you know, an issue right now is so much of like fMRI, or let's just say any functional imaging, because people are doing with ultrasound and CT and that kind of stuff too, is how do you actually translate what we're doing in research into clinical use, right? Where we're making a difference in, you know, daily patient lives. And I still think we have a ways to go. I mean, I think there's been some really cool research stuff. As you said, there's lots of literature and lots of studies, and I can tell you, coming out of the signal processing, imaging processing world, it's an area where you have to be careful, because people love to play with numbers and play with data and create pretty graphs and use all kinds of fancy mathematical techniques. And they publish a lot of stuff, but I always say there's a lot of garbage out there. Yeah. Because people made pretty graphs and say, look, we can do this and this and this. And in the end, as a biomedical engineer, I have to say, that's all great that you've done this for your own whatever research purposes or whatever, but it's still, you're on a fishing expedition, I would call it, as opposed to what is it you really want to answer and address. But more importantly, fill the literature with a lot of stuff that looks pretty, but in the end, what difference has it really made in patient care? And I think that's a question as biomedicals we have to ask. Not to say that we don't need just basic exploratory science, but I think, you know, the question needs to be asked more often of a lot of our biomedical engineering research is how much of it is really translating into patient care. And so you have, you know, some of these large, I would call them consortiums, whatever, like CTSI through, through the NIH that has been encouraging academic institutions, healthcare providers to get together to do a much better job of translating research into actual clinical care, right? So, because we spend a lot of money on medical research, but what does it take? And I think some of the things that keep that from happening are it's hard to do some clinical trials on these sorts of things and find the populations in which to do this and get it to a stage where you feel it's safe to be testing on humans, to what is the commercial value to some company that's going to take it and translate, pick it up and turn it into something, right? And so if they don't see that they're going to make enough money on it, it may not happen. Mm-hmm. To what are insurance, what are they going to cover? So we've had, there's some great technologies and devices we've developed, but if insurance company doesn't feel like it's worth reimbursing, it's probably never going to go anywhere. To physicians and what they're trained to do, right? So they're trained on certain types of technologies and they're all trained on how to read an ECG and stuff. So now when you want to make a major change to that, they can be really resistant to doing their jobs differently or providing different kinds of care because it's maybe hasn't been proven for decades and it's just not what they're comfortable with. So you've got these complicating factors, but I just think there needs to be more conversation about, okay, you've published all these great papers, but where is it really making a difference in actual healthcare? And as you can probably relate to, is affordable and accessible care too, right? And that conversation has been coming to the forefront in the last decade of even companies saying now, it can be really cool technology and science, but if we can't do it at a more affordable price, we're not going to do it either, right? Because there's a lot of pressure in that arena about what's being reimbursed and what you can charge for a patient and that kind of stuff. So that's a whole other aspect that many more biomedical engineers are getting excited about, I think, is affordable and accessible care. And the cell phone itself is a great device that is going to allow more of that to happen. It already is happening. And particularly in, you know, you think about even real remote countries that are maybe not so developed, but people all have some sort of, you know, cell phone technology. How do we make more use of that to make healthcare more accessible?
Oh, absolutely. That's a good point. You know, there's so many more technologies getting cheaper, smaller, more portable, and more, I guess, personalized. And so it's really cool to see some of the changes that are happening, both for accessibility, but also for ease of use with these kind of personal devices and these conversations that can now be had online with a doctor or information data being sent in real time, being collected with, like, you know, health devices and different apps like that, like Apple Watches. And, you know, it's all really blowing up. But one thing that you touched on that I think is also important that I would even add to is that there's kind of a responsibility that falls on the shoulders of science journalists, people, you know, like what I've been doing for several years, which is to help the public understand the importance, but also the limitations of the kind of research that you're talking about. Because you mentioned, you know, how fun and interesting it can be to manipulate big data. And I think a lot of people don't realize, for example, when you look at an fMRI study and you see that beautiful picture of a brain and the little red and yellow spots on the brain of where there's more activity, that these are like, this is compared to background activity, that this is averages across several subjects, that oftentimes with fMRI studies, the number of subjects that we use is incredibly small compared to most other kinds of experimental research. I mean, that most people think they're looking at a human brain when they look at an fMRI readout. And that's a failure, I think, on the part of the science journalism community as well.
Thank you. And it's great to have, you know, people like you who are speaking to that or understand that and appreciate it. And it's funny you bring that up because I do still teach. I love teaching and I love the students. So something I have not had to give up completely with in my administrative role, but I teach a statistics course to our biomedical engineers in the sophomore year. And it's a one credit course, one day a week sort of thing, but I try to make it very applied. And I say to them from the very first day, you know, first of all, this is not a math course. You're engineers. You can all do the math. That's the easy part. But I said, you're taking this course so that I hope the one thing you really take away is that this is all about how do I most fairly represent data. so that I can draw conclusions from it. Because I said, you're going to see a lot of misuse and a lot of misrepresentation. I even actually put up some headlines from newspapers where they're only reporting an average. And some of them are in such a way that students kind of laugh because they get right away what the problem is. But I said, when you see it in this form, it makes sense to you. Like the title, Man Drowns in a Pond with an Average Depth of 1 Foot, right? And, right? And you think, oh, you know, what was wrong with that person kind of thing? But I said, so it's obvious too, because they're only reporting the mean, right? You don't see the whole profile. But I said, think about how many things you read in the headlines every single day, whether it's food, diets, exercise, you know, kinds of things where they're only reporting a mean and they aren't reporting the variability. And you are totally misled in terms of what the real, what the data really represents and what kind of conclusions can be drawn. So I said, if nothing else, I just want to make you a more informed reader so that you question, and as you referred to, look at the sample size and where did they get the data? Was it from rats? And how different are we from rats? And if there are only 10 rats, you know, and I just yesterday, I gave them a simple assignment of rolling a dice 100 times and just plotting, you know, sort of the histogram and the distribution. And I said, that was 100 samples. I said, and how many of you got that nice flat distribution that you would expect? None of them. You know, most of them had these peaks and this and that. And I said, so think about this when you're reading a lot of biomedical research, where there's only 10 subjects, 20 subjects, and you're trying to make big conclusions about big populations based on those small numbers. And unfortunately, that's the way it is. So again, having them be more informed readers, be more critical about what they're reading, not to say there's not good stuff in that, but not just accepting the headline with the average, as you said, that you can use to hide many things.
And of course, you know, the feedback that I often get working both on Talk Nerdy and on the other podcast that I work on, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, which we really drill into this stuff to an even deeper level, is that, you know, your average everyday person who doesn't work as a biomedical engineer is like, how am I, expected to be able to sift through this and be able to make intelligent decisions and recommendations? Because I never had the option to go and take, you know, Dr. Ropella's class and learn about statistics and, you know, distribution anomalies with small sample sizes. Like, it's a lot to expect the general public to be as informed as we expect them to be with the science literacy at, you know, the level that it's at in American society right now.
You're right. And we, as, you know, people who've even been educated in higher education in these specific areas, even we have a hard time keeping up, right? I mean, the literature comes flying out this, technology is changing at great speeds, and we do. So to expect the public to, and yet the public is voting for your laws and your regulations and all these things going on. So I think one of the things that I do encourage, we have engineering students at times who do express a real interest in a love of writing, a love of communication, maybe want to get into that. So I really do encourage them to think about going into scientific writing and even scientific journalism to think about that, because I think there is a great need. They have a natural curiosity and a love for science and technology, obviously the same as you. And so, but they want to use this gift of theirs to be able to write and communicate and tell stories. And so another thing that we're trying to change in engineering is you don't have to always go out and do some of these more traditional jobs. We want you to think about different kinds of careers that you can do, that engineering education is really a good foundation, but go use it in other ways to make a difference in the world.
I love that. You know, I think it's really cool and refreshing to hear that within the kind of hallowed walls of academia that there are people like you who are reinforcing that science communication is actually a good use of somebody's time. And whether it becomes a career or something that they do on the side while they're working as scientists, that having a blog or going on podcasts or, you know, going on the nightly news to talk about a new discovery is actually good for the planet. And it's not like a waste of your academic brain or why aren't you in the lab longer hours? Because I think historically that was something that a lot of people I've talked to who did transition into SciComm were up against during that transition, was a lot of heavy persuasion not to do SciComm and to kind of stay in their lane, which is it's a huge bummer. It makes me think about all of the lost talent or the lost ability for communication that maybe never would be because somebody was dissuaded from doing that.
I completely agree. And I think it's unfortunate, I think, when, you know, whether it's professors or some of their mentors have only experienced a certain narrow path in their careers and that's the only path they talk about to their the people they're training and the people they're educating, right? As opposed to really encouraging, think about all kinds of things. I mean, our engineers go on to become patent lawyers and dentists and physicians, and we've got special programs that our engineers can go out and become K-12 STEM teachers. They're getting into sales, marketing, right? And so, and I point to a lot of our alumni who've been very successful in going to all these different professions and say, the world's your oyster, and your engineering degree is so such a good fundamental background to take into all these different professions, and go do it. And we all have to be, it's about becoming a problem solver. That's what engineers learn, how to think critically and how to problem solve. And you need that in every profession and area of every life. So encouraging that, as opposed to sort of having them think very narrowly about, well, you can only do, these are the traditional paths that you can do. And sometimes it's having that hard conversation with their parents. And we've all had to do that, right, at some point. And just giving them the support to do that. And as I like to say, some of my students who have particularly, helicopter parents, or the parents who won't sort of give them that freedom to think about where they best use their gifts, you know, I like to say to them, your parents already got to live their life. They don't get to live your life too, right? I mean, that's just a message that sometimes we have to help them express to their parents. But, and not just in writing, but I think we need engineers. We try to tell our engineers and scientists, you also have to play a role in advocacy for your field. So I've gone to the Hill, Capitol Hill, and I've met with legislators, you know, to talk about, you know, medical devices and healthcare and the things they need to be supporting in terms of medical research. No one else is going to do that for us. And so you'll see faculty getting upset because budgets have been cut at NIH or NSF and, you know, for research and stuff. And it's like, well, what are you doing to encourage those people to vote in a certain way or think it's important? No one else is going to do that. You speak the language. You understand the importance. You're going to have to go to Capitol Hill. You're going to learn how to do advocacy, right? Maybe you write letters to your congresswoman or man. And so getting them to think that way too, that it is their, as you said, it's their responsibility to speak some of the language and be an advocate for the profession and not expect other people to do it on our behalf.
It's true. And, you know, and that's also, as you mentioned, even a potential other full yes. career path for somebody who's trained in these areas. I think that's a really cool thing about engineering. And obviously, to some extent, it applies to all of the STEM yes. fields. But there is something kind of special about engineering, where there's just so many things you can do with this kind of degree. There's so many industry opportunities. There's so many academic opportunities. There's so many policy opportunities. I mean, I bet you we could sit here for the rest of the time that we talk just making a list of jobs that people could get after this kind of training. You must have former students that work in so many different areas.
Yeah, and that's part of the fun of my job. I spend a good percentage of my time in external relations with alumni, donors, industry partners. And I think one of the most fun parts of that job is just looking at where all our alumni have gone and the cool things that they've done with their careers and their lives and some very non-traditional paths and hearing their stories. And I get to bring that back to the college all the time and to our students and say, hey, I met this person. And as the student's telling me about their gifts and their interests, I can say, I need to put you in touch. Like, you should hear about the path that this person has taken that many wouldn't think is typical of an engineer. And yet our alumni are proof all the time. I see our alumni are living proof of all the cool things you can do. And every one of them will tell you how important that engineering degree was, even though it seems like they're doing stuff that you wouldn't anticipate an engineering graduate to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super, super cool. So there is a segment that I always do at the end of the show that I close it out with, but we're not quite there yet. So before we get to that, I wanted to make sure I remember to ask you if there are any cool projects going on, if there's anything new that you've been involved with or that your department has been involved with that you wanted to share, cool new research, interesting people, anything along those lines.
Yeah, we've got a number, I think, of some new things that we're undertaking right now. Well, we have great research, and particularly if you look at like our water quality group being here in Milwaukee with a great lab right in our backyard with a big lake. Our water quality group works with a number of other academic institutions as well as about 22 different companies in what they call an NSF consortium to address water quality problems. And that's always been a big thing here in Milwaukee. And as you hear about what goes on in Flint, Michigan, and you know the shortages down in the Southwest, we have people who are really involved in that and taking a lead in it. So I'm really excited about what that group is doing. I think we've got some great new stuff going on in advanced manufacturing. And as manufacturing comes back to the U.S. and maybe in very different forms, we think a lot about what does that workforce development mean for advanced manufacturing, as well as the technologies that might be used, robotics, AI, that kind of stuff. So doing some cool things in that, good stuff going in medical imaging. Really, we touch many different areas in energy and sensors and even smart buildings and smart infrastructure, and working with companies on what will the work environments look at the future. One of the big sort of concepts we're working on is something called the Innovation Alley, which is that collection of programs, people, and really spaces where we want to create sort of that space where companies and academia come together to do a much better job of taking new ideas, new research, new discoveries, and turning them into real businesses and commercial products. And our students are steeped in that, that entire pathway as in terms of making that happen. And really think of the engineering school and the business school are important anchors to that, but really bringing in all disciplines, as we've talked about before, because innovation happens when you have a collision of all these different lenses on the world and different disciplines. So we are really working on it now to do something very different from Milwaukee, and where we want to take a lead in sort of creating this innovation alley. So in the spirit of Milwaukee, small businesses that started in garage and mom and pop shops and grew into, you know, great things, how do we make more of that sort of happen in campus and giving industries the opportunity to maybe work on problems and challenges that they don't have time to do in their own walls, but come here out of those walls. We all sort of get out of our silos and create a space and place and programs that allow us to do more of that collision, and hopefully helping from an economic sense of what happens in Milwaukee, as well as workforce development. So that's another exciting sort of initiative that we're working on right now. The other thing that we're doing is we have a large grant from the GHR Foundation for about $5 million over the next 5 years to completely rethink our graduate programs. And we call it Masters Beyond Boundaries. And so certificate, masters, other sort of continuing education and graduate level programming that's very different than what we've maybe had in the past. And again, as opposed to just traditional engineering classes that people do, bringing in business and bringing in law and bringing in sociology and theology, given our sort of Jesuit mission and how we do more for people already out there practicing and professionals to meet their needs. So we're having a lot of dialogue with companies. What do you really need in your let's say, practicing engineers as they move forward? Many of them will talk to leadership development as well as business acumen. So thinking about how we do more of that for our practicing engineers who are out there.
Very, very cool. So, I mean, it sounds like obviously there's a lot of really interesting innovation to follow, but also for any of the folks listening today who are, you know, maybe finishing up their high school or even their undergraduate education, knowing that these opportunities exist for training, you know, keep your eyes open, read more, and learn about some of these programs for sure. So, Chris, when we close the show, we always ask, I talk about myself as if I'm more than one person. That's very strange.
Me too. I do too. That's a good thing.
Good to know. It's like the show and me, we're kind of the same, yep, but we are working together. So I always ask my guests the same two questions. And because of your position, both in STEM, but also in leadership, I'm definitely interested in your take on these two questions. So they really are big picture questions. So get ready for that. I'd love to know, first, when you think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you right now, you know, it can be a very personal context or a much more global, even cosmic context. Number one, what is the thing, if you had to pick one, that really is keeping you up at night, that you are really concerned about and maybe even border on like pessimistic or cynical about, you know, something that's like a true, maybe even existential concern. But on the flip side of that, you know, so we end on a high note. What are you legitimately and authentically optimistic about? You know, where do you really have a lot of put a lot of stock into things looking up?
Great questions. You know, what keeps me up most often is the finances really of higher education, and particularly spiraling tuition rates, right? It's and everybody talks about it, right? The costs continue to go up and we can't keep doing it, and we are trying to do cost containment. And as we think about the economics of higher education, what does it mean for the future in terms of how we're going to deliver education? What will a college experience be for students? How will that impact faculty and the way we think about faculty roles and how we reward and how do we evaluate faculty performance to will we do everything within walls or will it, you know, is it all online, that kind of stuff. And I bring it from a point of view of there, you know, this college this 4-year college education, and people will say, oh, you know, is that going to still be around? And if companies don't believe in degrees, how will that change? And, you know, that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of, I really love the college population, especially that 18 to sort of 25, because there's a lot of change in growing up that goes in that time. And I feel very mm-hmm. privileged to be part of that, right? So we see these people come in and they're someone's son or daughter, right? And pretty much their life has sort of been, you know, dictated by, you know, 4 years here, this is what you do your life, to after 4 or 5, maybe 6 years, leaving here with hopefully a very different perspective of who am I, what are my gifts, how do I contribute to the world, how can I bring my best self, and how do I challenge what is in making a better future. I mean, that's at least part of our mission here. And so if this experience, you know, so a good percentage of their time is not just sitting in classes and doing the academic part, but it's the whole socialization piece of it, right? I'm living in an environment with a lot of other, we have a very residential, and so they're in a sort of a safe place, but away from mom and dad, where they're given an opportunity to explore and learn the hard way about, you know, self-discipline and restraints and that sort of things. But we also take their brains and crunch them really hard and make them think about things that they haven't had to. And sometimes it's really hard and difficult, but there's so much that goes on there. And I, you know, my concern is if young people someday sit in their bedroom in their parents' home and they do all their college education online, oh my God, we're in big trouble in this society if that happens. And people, industry will be hiring some very questionable, you know, sort of workforce as well. So I think a lot about, it's become very expensive and we know we can't keep doing that. So how is higher education going to change? And there can be some really good change. We have good change all the time in the way we think about what we do in our classrooms, what we do in our labs, how students live in the residence halls. I mean, there's all good stuff in change. I'm not opposed to that. But I just sort of think long-term, what is that economic driver going to do in terms of maybe it'll totally dismantle higher education and it's going to be disrupted in ways that we don't even know? I don't know. So those are the things that sort of keep me up. What am I optimistic about? I'm optimistic about the young people we're educating today. So when you tend to hear, you know, all the negative things, whether it's millennials or Gen Y or whatever, I have the joy of, I've been here, 29 years now. So I've seen a couple different decades come through. And it's a joy. There's many great things about our young people today. And I feel very privileged to be with them, sit with them, talk with them, socialize with them in so many different ways. And yeah, there's differences. They deal with different technologies. They have communicate differently because of what technology has done with it for them. They socialize differently, but they are passionate and they want a good world. And in a lot of ways, their values are sometimes in a better place than generations before us. I'm optimistic of where they're bringing the world and the good things and the good changes that they'll make.
You know what? I am too. You know, I think that obviously there's value. There's value to the concerns about changes. But I think also as we all get older, we all think that the generation in front of us is, you know, less educated, lazier, whatever. And so much of that is just bias. And there is so much cause to be optimistic. In many ways, we have to be optimistic. Yes. But in other ways, it's good to see that there's proof in the pudding and that there really is good data to support the fact that, you know, young people are innovative, that they are interested in continuing their education, and that they are solving these massive global problems because they're more connected than ever before. They have access to more information and technology than ever before, and they are willing to kind of break the rules in order to solve those problems. And so that's, to me too, it's a real cause for optimism in my life as well.
I agree. It's wonderful. And, you know, I have 3 children of my own, and it's just been a joy to watch where they're going with their lives and the choices they're making and the good things that I think they'll be doing for the world. And yeah, it's fun to be part of all of that.
Well, Chris, this has just been a wonderful chat. I'm interested, where can people go to learn more about both, you know, your work and the things that you do, but also about your institution?
Good question. Our website, mu.edu/engineering.
Awesome. And they can find pretty much everything they need to find if they click around for hours
you
and
bet.
Hours.
Yeah, if they click around, they'll find all kinds of good stuff. Our communications director, Lexi, has been on top of that and making sure that we're putting our best foot forward in what we put out to the world to see.
Excellent. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining me. It really has been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. It's been delightful. And I keep up this great work and bringing these various voices to the world, because it's really, what you're doing is really, really important. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time that we all get together to talk nerdy.